Welcome to Museum Chill, a podcast by the International Council of Museums, where we talk everything and anything museums. This is Ana Paula from ICOM, and today we're kicking off a special short series inspired by our invitation to the groundbreaking event, World Building Art and Technology in a Climate Change World, hosted at the Serpentine Gallery, an ICOM institutional member. As the climate crisis reshapes our world, the role of museums is evolving, and cultural institutions are stepping into new transformative roles as educators, collaborators, and advocates for systemic change. Our guest today is Suzanne Dhaliwal, a visionary climate justice creative and strategist whose work redefines activism through art, decolonization, and collaborative storytelling. As we reflect on ICOM's recent participation at COP29, where culture and heritage were championed as integral components of climate action, Suzanne's insights offer a powerful starting point. Her work challenges museums to move beyond the walls of their institutions, embracing their potential to lead global conversations on climate justice and sustainable development. Before we start, a quick note, this episode was live recorded, so you may hear some background noises, and we hope it doesn't distract you a lot. Thank you for your understanding. Firstly, thank you for being here. Just wanted to start by saying I think your experience is impressive. I was reading a lot through it as well. And from your experience exactly in connecting cultural institutions and relevant actors all around the world, how can museums authentically center Indigenous, Black, and POC voices in their climate narratives and exhibitions without falling into tokenism?
I think one of the first steps is to acknowledge the history and to understand, you know, we're sitting in London here where we know that so many of the artifacts and cared for objects have come there through often violent means. But I think that we're really in a moment where the history and acknowledgement of that past isn't just for us to all feel bad about the history. It's for us to think about the future. Future of these objects, the future of the conversations. And actually, I feel very motivated and inspired by so many of the conversations that I have with curators and directors of galleries. I feel like there's a real willingness to acknowledge that history. And I think that the cultural community should really congratulate itself that it's become part and parcel, that there's no way now that we can actually think about the future of the museum without rectifying that. So I think some of the ways that that can happen is to really invest in educational departments to, you know, accompany some of these exhibitions with that history and that analysis to understand the experience when we see our heritage, when we see that it would be great to have educational materials that acknowledge that history. Then the other thing would be to invest in the next generation of curators, of makers, and to allow us to not only be, you know, the additional content, but to be the ones who are imagining the spaces and also the function of the museum. I think that's a really exciting part as well, that what do we need from the museum at this time? We need it, yes, to continue to care for our objects, to curate beautiful gallery spaces, but we also need spaces to convene, to think together, to research together, and to also be a space where artists, activists, and thinkers can also begin to imagine new forms as well.
Yeah, and on that note, the campaigns that you've worked on, at least some of the ones you've shared with me before, normally use powerful artistic interventions, more so to bring attention to climate issues. What role do you think museums can play in fostering this type of creative strategies, and how can they collaborate with artists, as you're saying, to give them the space and also to recognize them as part of? How would you think in actions specifically, it's how museums can engage with all these artistic interventions?
I think one of the beginning ones is a really simple one, is access.
Yeah.
Again, we're sitting in London, and I wonder how many youth from South London have ever had the luxury to walk through the Serpentine yesterday afternoon. We saw a beautiful exhibition. So I think really thinking about access for communities who say, you know, here on the front line of air pollution, who are facing police brutality.
Yeah.
So not only in an educational sense, but to have a moment of liberation, to have a moment of joy on a rainy day to witness this work. So continuing to invest in access, that's the first one. The other one would be to, you know, really think about residencies and supporting more residencies either in the gallery or in nature space that allows artists to have time together to process, to share experience, to build communities. And that, you know, that can be across those who are experiencing oppression or not,
yeah.
And through those dialogues. And then also, you know, pathways as well. How can you create that generosity of the space that can then also support funding to go to those kinds of works?
Yeah.
And expanding what we mean by art. So for me, I studied social sculpture. So having a panel, having a space where we think together, for me, is a work. That's an invisible form. And that material that we create when we think and convene together, I consider a work. So as we expand our ideas as well about what we think are works, I think that will also create a plethora of opportunities to invite in people who are doing liberatory work.
Yeah, and it's true that by really learning about other projects and initiatives is where you can actually see how and where we can collaborate with other actors and where we're missing maybe parts on our own projects and how we can add them to either someone else's initiative or our own. And that for me was incredibly impressive. We were talking to some of the people in there, not only the panelists, but also the people intervening just in general, where we were discussing what ICOM does and what we're looking at and just seeing how many other countries as well. And I mean, ICOM is a global institution, but here at being at the UK, in the UK, we were learning from initiatives in India, initiatives in Australia. So all of these things are so far from each other, but at the same time, we're working towards the same kind of goal. And it's super interesting to see where we can meet and we can maybe share each other's learnings. And
I think that's a beautiful point. And I think what you bring up there, again, being in London, is also with diaspora communities. Like, I don't even know who are all the Indian artists who are working in climate change in a contemporary sense as well, I think. And again, going back to basics, when I'm doing this work, I'm often looking who are the artists who are even doing this work. Yeah. So even catalogues, even profiling those artists, being a contact where we can know who are the artists doing this work in that space is so valuable for us to build this community. And I think that last point there about contemporary diasporic in like collaborations, because also if you go around England, the way India is represented will be at the Wellcome Collection, as we're a history of the past. And I think that decolonial moment could be powerful, because sometimes we see more advanced or like incredible like solutions based architectural works coming from India, coming from Africa, and to be able to like create more dialogue between artists here, I think would be absolutely incredible.
Previously in the work you've done, you've spoken about the need to decolonize climate media and communications. What steps can museums take to decolonize their own narratives around climate change, especially when they're partnering with indigenous or frontline communities?
I've actually been doing some research, learning from Sotheby's around this, and I feel like Sotheby's is actually currently leading a curatorial course, which is so deeply embedded in this decolonial practice. So I think I see that the new generation of curators who are coming out are being schooled in a way that 101 understanding of decolonial history, understanding how representation enforces it, but more interestingly is the strategies that have already happened to disrupt that. So as simple as, you know, thinking about how we juxtapose objects, how we go into the collections that we already have, how we're honest with that history, but we're doing it in a way that is engaging. And I think the last thing is not always lecturing, but creating moments for contemplation on this so that we can all be part of the conversation. So, you know, not being shouted at, but being offered to also reflect on our own histories, and also then creating space for, the new generation. And also I think not homogenizing what that decolonial experience looks like. And I think that that multiplicity is critical to also making sure that we're not replicating colonialism in the decolonization process.
Yes. We had a guest last year when we were talking about the museums of human rights around the world, and she was the director of FIRM at the time. She was talking about how in Argentina the Museo de la Democracia, so the Democracy Museum, had opened their doors right after the protest for climate change had started in museums, because they realized that while, yes, it's important to protect everything that's inside a museum, it was also important to be part of the conversation. So by opening their doors, they basically invited the protesters to use the space with agreements in between each other to really just collaborate together to see how museums and community and society could work towards communicating the needs that we have at the time with climate change. And I thought that was super interesting, just to say how museums are so much more than we can see at times. It's not only an experience, it's not only for us to go and see, it's also for us to go and leave and actively act on them. And I thought that was just super interesting on how we could actively work with communities.
Exactly. And I think, you know, the Francis Morris, who was the former head of the Tate, has really been a beacon in terms of that, in terms of we had incredible dialogues around decolonization. And I think that openness and support, actually, the support for the directors of museums, you know, we've seen lots of activism of, like, you know, paint and soup being thrown at works. And while I can understand the terror and the fear that drives people those actions, how do we support the gallery workers who have been enshrined with the responsibility to care for those works at this time? And how do we support them in dialogue to understand, like, what are the shifts in policy that we need then to be able to both respond to the crisis but also continue that custodianship? So I think there's an interesting space there, even amongst the museums, for, like, what is the shifting policy of care? What do we mean by care at this time? And also when those, I was just speaking with someone also about not only climate change, but there's also complicity around the war industrial complex. You know, if you're taking the funding streams and having those conversations about funding streams and questioning it, but also understanding the pressures to continue to fund these institutions. So how can we creatively imagine the future of funding streams, the future of the economies that surround museums as well? So I think that same care that we give to the objects, we should also give to the directors and the staff holding those museums.
It was literally what I wanted to ask you. How can museums navigate the complexities of funding and corporate sponsorship, because it comes to a point where they don't necessarily align with the values that they want to go and use the sponsorship for. So is there anything that you can share with us as to how they can consider, how they should consider their partners for funding?
I think, you know, the first thing is to have an internal conversation about the values, about this moment, you know, this movement to call out fossil fuel company sponsorship, to call out companies that are connected to genocide and war. It's not going to go away. It's only going to escalate. So having very clear lines around what is their values and what is a red line, I think, is going to be critical. Then becoming, you know, sharing knowledge about who are the foundations, who are the funders, corporate or non-corporate, who do align with those values. And how can we share that knowledge? And then the other part is also, and this is maybe a little bit speculative, but we are in a world of emerging new media, of new art. What could be the role of generating income from, I think we're post NFTs, but
maybe.
But, you know, there's a whole realm of income generation from digital art, from new media as well. So are there spaces that we need to think more creatively about how we bring that work in, and unwrestling ourselves a little bit maybe from the lack of freedom that gifting and sponsorship, and then also, you know, that's a call to the wider cultural community, like celebrities and pop stars who do care about culture, to think about investing in it so that we can have that freedom at this critical moment. But my first, you know, and all of that just starts with that first honest internal conversation, which again I think people like Francie Morris have like really led on that reflection. And I think, you know, when COVID happened, we had to suddenly galleries had to create emergency meetings overnight to respond to that. So we know how to do it. And we will also need to, we see galleries and museums responding to, you know, the changing weather conditions, adaptation, conservationship. So that same innovation, and when we're thinking about your the carbon footprint of your works, that should include the carbon footprint of your piggy bank as well.
It's true. It's actually, our last episode on this was with Mumo. I don't know if you know this project. It's a mobile museum, and it's this big trucks that Ingrid started working on to have to move basically a museum towards communities, towards kids as well, because oftentimes our communities are being left on the side because museums at times are just perceived as this intellectual space rather than an interactive area as well, because of course there's so many type of museums, so it's not necessarily all for all, but definitely a museum, it's also for everyone. So in this case, she was talking about how she started these mobile museums in France, and they was just in a place, so she didn't have to consider a lot of factors. But then she brought it to I think to Côte d'Ivoire and other countries in Africa, and then she realized, okay, now I have to really consider how this space needs to also curate the art pieces, and see how she will also maintain this space for anything when kids are coming in. So I think all these factors are super interesting to consider, as you're mentioning, also for how it moves, because it's interesting for us to have it move, but how does that works and how does it impact
it's amazing, because one of the projects I worked on was a memorial bus for the Kensarawiwa, and it was with the British Nigerian sculptress Sakari Douglas Camp, and she out of steel made this giant bus which had the names of the Ogoni Nine who were killed by shell on the bus, and inside it was a cinema and a library. And this bus travelled across the UK, and it educated both, you know, the British public. It was also for Nigerian diasporic communities to understand the history of Kensarawiwa and the Ogoni Nine. And then what happened was, on the anniversary of Kensarawiwa's death, the community requested that it came back to Nigeria. And I remember being tasked with this project of getting the bus back to Nigeria, working with Platform, UK-based organisation. And it felt so absurd. It was like, in all this work that we have to do, we're sending this bus back to Nigeria. But it was also the almost the ludicrousness of it was beautiful, because it was this symbol of solidarity to go home. What actually happened was the bus fell in the sea at the dock.
No.
And then it was recovered. It was cleaned. It was sent to Nigeria. And when it got to Nigeria, it was impounded by the Nigerian government and the same colonel who was responsible for the death of Kensarawiwa. The sculpture was impounded and we've never seen it again. But what happened was, the incredible artist Alfredo Yar was involved as well in the campaign around this, and late John Daniel, who was an amazing graphic designer, and this whole movement emerged in Nigeria to free the bus. And it turned into a social media campaign. It was on Nigerian radio, and all to save the bus. And it brought the message of Kensarawiwa and the Ogoni Nine to a whole new generation. So in that moment, this act, this beautiful solidarity act to bring this bus back to bring it to Nigeria became an incredible social movement. So in that moment, the museum was mobile, it was ephemeral, and then it was active even when it didn't exist. Invisible bus, the magic invisible bus. So I tell that story to say exactly that, this reimagining what the museum is, how it functions, how it moves, how it captures the imagination, how it works in its invisibility even, and also the emerging campaigns. And I think that's something about when you mix art and solidarity, then something magical happens.
It does. It's it's super inspiring, actually. What's one thing you hope to see more museums do in the next few years to support climate action?
I would like to see something, spaces that really go back to the core of interdisciplinary practice, intersectional practice, and intergenerational practice. So having been a climate activist, the reason why I came home to art is because I've seen the lack of research space, real research space that allows us to bring disciplines together, that allows us to imagine new forms, that allows us to connect scientists and artists and designers, that gives us the freedom to think and to imagine. So I would love to see, incubation hubs fostering that. Obviously, more content on climate change, but I would like to see that content curated by those people who are on the front lines of the crisis, and also the investment in that capacity to make those works too.
Beautiful.
Thank you for tuning in into this episode of Museum Chill. We hope Susanne's insights have inspired you to think about the vital role museums can play in driving climate action and justice. If you would like to learn more about the International Council of Museums and our mission to support sustainable development, cultural heritage, and community engagement, visit icom.museum. Don't forget to follow us on your favorite podcast platform and social media to stay updated on future episodes on this series, where we will continue to explore how museums, art, and technology can shape a better, more sustainable world. Thank you.